I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
One, two, three, four! Welcome to the Badass Women's Hour podcast with me, Harriet Minter. This is the podcast where I round up the best bits from our radio show on Talk Radio. This week we meet Parth Patel, who talks about why the new lockdown rules are still harming the Black Asian minority ethnic community more than the white community, and just what the government needs to do to change that. Plus, Dr. Angelina Osborne introduces 100 Great Black Britons, and Tina Wilson talks about her new dating app, which lets your friends decide who you should go out with. First up, it's Parth Patel.
This is the Badass Women's Hour podcast.
Now, as we head towards, dare I say it, another lockdown, there are certain communities that are more worried about the impact on them than others. One of those being the Black Asian minority ethnic community. We know from studies that were done during the last lockdown that the number of deaths, the infection rate was much higher amongst that community. And so scientists, doctors are calling for a greater understanding of how we can reach them. Joining us now, Parth Patel, who has worked on the report around the impact on the BAME community for the Institute of Public Policy and Research. Hi, Parth.
Hey, Harriet. Thanks for having me on.
That's no problem. Tell us a little bit about what your research has shown about the impact of lockdown rules on the BAME community.
So our research is actually focused on how we can mitigate these disparities that exist in COVID-19. So what we know from earlier in this year is that COVID isn't affecting everyone equally. There's a 2-4-fold difference in your risk of dying from COVID, depending on what ethnic community you're looking at compared to the white British population. We know these disparities exist, yet we've not seen any action to mitigate them. What the government has done is has acknowledged them. It says, wow, these inequalities exist. They're pretty stark. They've set up a new commission. They've refunded some new research. And that's all very welcome to better understand the problem. But what it's done almost is it's distracted us from what's happening on the ground. And what's happened on the ground, Harriet, is nothing. There's been no tailored or concerted action to better protect these minority ethnic communities from COVID. And what we'll see and what's already playing out is that these disparities are repeating.
What could happen here? What could be done? Because I'm thinking about it and I'm thinking, well, is it going to get complicated if we have different messages for different communities? It's already complicated enough trying to work out who should be doing what when. How could we make it better, in your opinion?
Yeah, that's exactly what the focus of our work at the IPPR is on. And it's no small task. I think it's important to remember that these inequalities, they're nested in a much bigger problem, and that's the problem of systemic racism. COVID is just running along these racist grooves in our society. It didn't create them, but it's exposing them. It's maybe deepening them, but it didn't create them. So there's no easy fix here, and it's going to take a lot to dismantle this gargantuan structural racism. And so what we're saying is that we can't resolve, completely address these inequalities by this winter, but we can reduce them. And that's exactly what the focus of the work is. So what can we do? That takes us back to actually what's causing these disparities. And no one's quite managed to pin this down here. When we look at the differences in the risk, the 2-4-fold differences in death from COVID, depending on your ethnic group, we're saying maybe if we look at that risk, we can explain away about half of it. We could say about half of this chunk of this disparity is to do with deprivation and geography. But there's this other big chunk that we don't quite understand at the moment. And that's the motivating factor behind all this new research, which is very welcome. I myself am a recipient of some of that research in my other job at UCL. But what, I guess what we can, what, when we think about the action that needs to happen, we think a bit simply, a bit more simply. So what we know, what do we know is that first, minority ethnic communities are more likely to get a COVID infection. They're more likely to get infected. That's the first thing. And the second thing we know is that when they do get the infection, when they have COVID, they seem to suffer more harm from it. So the consequences of having COVID are greater for you. And so we could plan our action and policy around that. The first one, if we know they're getting the infection more commonly, let's better protect these communities from COVID. And then when they do have the infection, we know that they're having greater harm. So actually, let's increase access to treatment and support for these communities. And those are the two main pillars we can think about to reduce these inequalities this winter, if that makes any sense.
It does. But one of the things that I hear a lot is that the reason there are more cases within minority ethnic communities is because those communities are more likely to have more generations living together, greater numbers of people living together, and therefore it passes around quicker. Is that true?
It's a common thought, and the data is still unclear. So that's maybe one of the first point there. We don't actually quite have that data yet, and maybe that's a problem as to why we don't have that level of quality sort of data by ethnicity at that level. But it's anecdotally that's what's been said, and it's likely it's definitely contributing to some extent. Now we don't know how much that's contributing, but we think that it's probably important. Yes.
And if the government is to try and address some of these issues, is it going to be able to do it using, I guess, the test and trace apps that it's set up now, the kind of the messaging it's sending out there? Is it going about it in the right way?
Yeah, and my answer to that is it's probably not. So the approach the government's taken is sort of a one-size-fits-all broad brush approach. And really, the communication for me and you, Harry, it's already very mixed and muddled and U-turny. And what people don't think of, actually, sort of metaphorical terms like shielding, it's not obvious to everyone what that means. Social bubbles, it's not clear to everyone what that means. And there's not been any tailored communication for various communities to understand. So that's sort of the first point. Now, on test and trace, I could sit here all day and talk about that. Testing capacity is so obviously lacking, and that's there as an obvious point. But tracing is the way we go about doing tracing. It's a clear and active choice, and that's less about having resources available. So relationships and engagement are a necessary first step in contact tracing. You have to be able to trust the person on the other end of the phone. And the way to do that is to go through the local public health teams, the local teams who can collaborate and work with community organizations, with religious leaders, to better reach these communities, to make sure that the messages are getting through and people are understanding sort of what they need to do and why this is important, as opposed to sort of it being beckoned out from the center and this big gargantuan NHS test and trace system, which we know already and in the data that it's actually not as effective as the local teams. So then the question, I guess, then is why has the centralized test and trace system got £10 billion worth of funding, whereas the local authorities, which have been slashed for over the past decade with austerity, just received a minuscule £300 million in comparison?
I mean, that is a great question. Why do you think that has happened? Is it? I put that to you, Parth. What do you think is going on there?
So I wouldn't want to speculate on how the government is giving out its contracts and deciding who should be running our test and trace system and what's going on there. I think it's very opaque, and I think that's annoyed a lot of us. We can't quite see what the rationale and the logic is as to giving out these big private sector contracts to firms that have absolutely no experience in public health. They've never worked in public health or contract tracing ever, whereas these local teams have been there for ages and know their communities. So I think from the outside, without having a foot in government, I just cannot see a single reason as to why they would have gone about awarding the contracts in that manner.
I want to talk about something else you raised earlier, which is around the fact that a lot of minority ethnic communities are more likely to be in a financially precarious situation. How do you think that is impacting on the infection rates, and what would you like the government to be doing about it?
Yeah, and that's absolutely right. But IPPR, actually, this week we released some work that was looking at how the debt and finances have fallen unequally since the start of the pandemic. We showed that if you weren't white, you're twice as likely to be worried about paying your bills this winter. You were twice as likely to be out of work since the pandemic started. And that, of course, interplays with how easy it is for you to isolate. If you're working a job that probably is public-facing, gig economy, low wage, if you don't have access to statutory sick pay, that's going to affect your impact, your ability to isolate. And I mean, it's there in the data, but actually, I think what people forget is that there are individuals behind all these numbers. And just think of an example from when I was working in A&E. It was these sorts of questions that absolutely flummoxed me. Someone would come up to the door and they'd be well enough to not need to come to the hospital, sort of saying, you've probably got the coronavirus, but I can't test you because we haven't got enough tests for people who aren't coming to the hospital. Right. So just go home and isolate and don't go to work for a few weeks and it'll be fine. But if you get worse, make sure you come back in. And then getting questions back like, okay, doc, that's fine, but if I don't go to work, if I don't drive my taxi for the next 2 weeks, I can't pay my bills. I won't be able to feed my children. And then it just being absolutely flummoxed and not knowing what to say back to that is what was going on.
Are any of the government grants they've announced going to help? I think they've announced one which says if you have to isolate, we'll give you some money, things like that. Can that help in this situation?
Absolutely, yeah. So that is imperative. And I'm actually going to say well done to the government. Very recently, they've announced a new package of £500 to isolate. It was initially trialled at a much smaller amount, £120 or so. And I think there were calls around the country saying, this is the right initiative, but you need a lot more money than that. And they've listened to that. So kudos to the government. It's now, I think, £500 to isolate if you need to and if you're a low-wage worker. The issue with that is that it's not being rolled out. You can't claim until, I think, the 28th of September. And I don't think it's even the machinery is going to be there till mid-October. You have to claim through your local authority in a backlog. So you have to sort of get through the month and then claim it back later. And as we just said, the fears about paying your bills for the next 3 months and how that falls unequally depending on your ethnicity. It's just the real politic of that on the ground is not fully considered.
Well, do you think part of the reason that some of these things haven't been taken into consideration is due to the makeup of our current government? We look at it, it's a lot of white, middle class, majority men making the decisions about this. Do you think they just don't have perhaps the life experiences to consider some of this stuff?
That's an interesting question, Harriet. So on that latter point, I think life experiences are important. I think having diversity has epistemic value. It's important. But at the same time, I don't think it's as simple as that. I think the issues we're talking about, issues of racial justice, I don't think it matters what colour you are to be driven by that issue. I think it's more about if what motivates you and what your values are, and if values of justice and fairness are something that you hold highly, addressing inequality, the government's serious about levelling up beyond just rhetoric. I think it would engage with this issue seriously, and it hasn't, but it's not just been this administration. These issues of racial justice haven't really been engaged with properly for a long time.
Excellent point. Parth, thank you so much for joining us and talking to us this evening. It's Parth Patel, working on the report there around how the current lockdown rules are still harming the Black, Asian, minority ethnic communities here in the UK for the Institute of Public Policy Research.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is the Badass Women's Hour podcast. You can get in touch on all the socials on @BadassWomen'sHour.
Here on Badass Women's Hour XL, we love somebody who sees a part of history that hasn't been given enough attention and just decides to change it. And that's what our next guest did. Dr. Angelina Osborne realised that we simply didn't know enough about the great Black Britons of our history. And so she created a campaign called 100 Great Black Britons to bring them to light. A long overdue book with the same name is now out, and it honours the remarkable achievements of some key Black British individuals over history, and not just the ones you think you know. She joins us now. Hi, Angelina.
Hello there. Good evening.
First of all, tell me where the idea for the campaign came from.
Okay, so back in 2003, there was a BBC sort of national campaign called 100 Great Britons, where people were invited to vote on who they thought the greatest Briton was. And of all the 100 people that people nominated, not one of the nominations were for anybody of African or Asian heritage. So in response to that that lack of any sort of African representation, Patrick Vernon and I, we started a campaign in 2003 called 100 Great Black Britons, which got a quite significant amount of attention. That particular campaign voted Mary Seacole, the Jamaican nurse, as the greatest Black Briton. So it was from back then.
And why have you decided to turn it into a book now?
Okay, so we did back in 2003. We had a website which is still there, but we thought having a book, a sort of much more sort of tangible kind of representation of different people throughout history, would be better. We were also sort of thinking about what was happening around the whole sort of Brexit discourse. As Britain voted to leave the EU in 2016, and also the scandal around people from the Windrush generation, we thought that it would be really sort of timely to revive the campaign and just to keep within the national consciousness the contributions of African and Caribbean people to the British historical narrative.
How has it changed running the campaign now, 17 years later, from when it first started?
Okay, so one of the key things that's really changed things is that the rise in social media, much more social media platforms. It means that many more people can get be aware of what we're doing. But we're also very sort of conscious. We've been doing lots. We've got this great schools competition, which has had a really overwhelming response. And also just, the social media has really kind of changed things for us.
Do you think people now are more or less aware of some of those great Black Britons?
It's really difficult to tell. I think it depends who you ask, really. I still think, from my point of view, that people still are not totally aware, not as aware as one would like, hence the revival of the campaign.
One of the things that I thought was really interesting about it is you say that actually lots of people sort of think of the Windrush generation as the first generation that really changed the ethnic makeup of Britain, but that's actually not true. And tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, I mean, you know, there's archaeological evidence that there were African people living in Britain from the Roman period. There's archaeological evidence of African people living in Britain in the medieval period. And there is evidence of a continuous African presence since the Tudor period. So the people who were living, Africans who were living here in the Tudor period, were from all walks of life. They were doing all different kinds of jobs. They had social and job mobility. Similarly, even during the period of the 18th century, at the height of the trade and trafficking in Africans, there was a sizable community of African people living here in Britain. It's estimates, different estimates by historians, but at least there's an estimate of 20,000 people, and certainly they were certainly visible enough for people like Hogarth to paint them and other painters to remark upon their presence. So we're talking about a consistent presence from at least 2,000 years.
When you put the campaign together, was there anything that you learnt or anything that surprised you?
One of the things that I learnt was about the story of a couple of boxers, Bill Richmond and Thomas Molyneux. They were both very successful bare knuckle boxers in the 18th century. And I found their stories quite remarkable, given especially that Bill Richmond didn't even really start boxing until he was 41 years old and became a champion. Yes, absolutely. And
it's never too late.
No, it's never too late to live your dreams, I guess. But he's also credited for designing sort of the boxing ring, so it was raised up in the way that we see it today. You know, he was and he was a very successful boxer. He had his own pub in central London, not far from Leicester Square. So you know, his story to me was particularly surprising. I'd heard of him, but I hadn't read, you know, in the course of doing the research for the book, I read much more greater detail about where his origins and his boxing record and what, and it was really, really surprising to me that how successful he was.
Why do you think campaigns like this are important?
I think campaigns like this are important because often it's the own, you know, you're not going to get, I don't know, it's because there's a lack of, it's not embedded enough into the national memory. So it's really important to keep doing these campaigns, to keep reminding people about the historical narrative being a global narrative rather than just a very narrow narrative, with the hope that one day and eventually that people will sort of put it in a place, embed it in a way that it's just common knowledge to everybody.
Would you like to see this taken on? You said you're doing some work on social media with schools. You've got a school campaign. Do you think actually we need to be really looking at the history curriculum of the UK and updating it almost?
Well, yes, absolutely. I think at the moment it's really an elective. You can choose to teach Black British history. It is not embedded as a compulsory element of the curriculum, so teachers can either choose to teach it or not. There are lots of really great, really terrific teachers who are really wanting this material, are teaching this, having material to teach in class in schools. But as I said, if you don't want to teach it, you don't have to, and that's the challenge that we continue to face today, is getting the government to appreciate the importance of it being embedded within the curriculum as compulsory and not as an elective.
And finally, are you expecting any new great Black Britons on the list this year?
I mean, there's all, you know, we had a list of well over 500 people. You know, we had a very, very large list that we had to sort of whittle down to the 100 that are in the book. So, you know, I think there's always scope for, you know, adding more people in different editions, you know, while people, and, you know, until, you know, once people get familiar with who's in the book, then we can then include those other people that we didn't include.
Who's your personal hero?
My personal hero is Claudia Jones. she's a woman. She is credited with starting the carnival, the Notting Hill Carnival, which first started in St. Pancras Town Hall in 1959. And the reason why she and others decided to have the carnival was because there was a lot of racial unrest. You know, as more and more Caribbean people started to settle here, there was a real backlash, and they were being attacked a lot. You know, attacked, beaten up on the streets, and so there were two disturbances, I would say, in Notting Hill in Nottingham in 1958. And as a way sort of for cohesion to bring people together, this was one of the ideas that could bring people together, bring Caribbean Britons and white Britons together, was through culture and music and celebrating each other's music and a sort of cultural exchange. And so the Notting Hill Carnival in its first manifestation was pretty much a brainchild of Claudia Jones.
She's a great pick. And it sounds fantastic. I believe the book is out now. 100 Great Black Britons. Dr. Angelina Osborne, thank you so much for starting the campaign, brilliant idea, and also coming on to talk to us all about it and about your heroes as well. Thank you.
This is the Badass Women's Hour podcast. You can get in touch on all the socials on at Badass Women's Hour.
Are you finding yourself a little lonely? Are you facing the thought of another lockdown single with dread? Well, our next guest might be able to help you. Tina Wilson is the CEO and founder of the Wingman Dating App, an app that is designed to make dating a less solitary experience. It's not just you out there on your own. You can bring your wing men or women with you. She joins us now to talk about it. Hi, Tina.
Hi there. How are you?
Good, thank you. First of all, tell us, why did you decide to create a dating app?
Well, have you tried online dating? I mean, it's not for the faint-hearted.
It is not for the faint-hearted, I agree.
Do you know what? I came out of a long relationship, and when I came out, I realised everyone had moved online, and all of my girlfriends were in relationships, and so I turned to online dating reluctantly. But I had so many frustrating experiences that I just thought there has to be a different way. Like, I want something that's more in keeping with real life or a night out. And so I went about creating like what would be an ideal experience for like me and my friends. And what I didn't realize was that there's so many different people out there that had similar frustrations. And so, you know, we're bringing a completely different audience of person to the dating world that would normally not do it.
I really like this idea that actually you can get your friends involved, because I've definitely, you know, been on a night out with my girlfriends. When I was single, I'd give them my phone and they could swipe for me. They loved it. And you kind of incorporated that into the app. Is that right?
That is right. And you know what? We've all done it, right? We're great at giving advice. We're not always great at taking it. And I think the same can be said for the love life. So for me, Wingman is about creating opportunities and elevating our single friends when they may not be at their most confident, pushing them to kind of their best self. And for me, I never liked writing a bio for myself, and it's hard to be kind of promotional without sounding corny. But my friends, on the other hand, could describe me. And when one of my friends wrote a profile for me on a traditional dating site, I was like, oh, I sound quite excellent. Sounded a bit feisty, but a bit feisty, and it would have put a few people off. But actually, that was great in the long run, because I'm not for the faint-hearted. And so, you know, just by excluding those people, I was attracting people that, you know, were more in keeping with what I really needed in my life.
Do you think that we have tired of app dating in 2020, or has it flourished?
I mean, online dating as a whole is up over 350%, right? As people are forced. Yeah. And that's just traditional online dating. On Wingman, we're nearly at 500% increase in engagement. I know. And I think for us, it's been, you know, overall, you know, I'm talking more like the UK and the US markets, because that's where we are.
Yeah.
But traditional online dating is up 350% in both. So for me, it's because people don't want to put their love lives on hold. Right? People are more isolated than ever. And so they're finding different ways to connect with people. And I mean, thank God we have these platforms to connect. Otherwise, it would be so isolating, especially for the singles.
has COVID changed how we date? I mean, I know at the beginning of the whole pandemic, we were talking about how it was going to create a sort of a rise in slower dating where everyone took more time. Do you think that's actually happening?
I think it is happening. I definitely think we're seeing over a quality over quantity approach to dating, with hookup culture being dead and people not able to meet up casually as they were. People are taking longer to find out more about the person, and that kind of, it's not old fashioned courtship, but it's just more of a patient approach to dating. I think in the past we've been so, you know, at ease to find somebody that was a mile away from us and we could meet them immediately. That doesn't necessarily lead to great relationships. So I think even though it probably is a little slower, we're going to have more quality matches over time.
Do you think is there any new dating etiquette because of COVID? Anything we should or shouldn't be doing?
Well, I don't. Kissing is a no-no. We do various polls with our users, and 98% of singles said they would be horrified if somebody lent in for a date, lent in for a kiss. And I think now it's just checking in before you even get on a date that you are on the same page about what that looks like, whether that's social distancing and stuff. So many people have varying opinions as to what is okay, and that's a big divider before you even meet. But I think first date etiquette is definitely you need to check in and make sure that you're going to be comfortable when you do meet up.
I mean, I saw an article on the BBC the other day which was all about people having sex in masks. I was like, I feel like we're creating a generation of people with some very strange ideas about relationships.
I mean, it's definitely a bit more of a fetish side of the world, isn't it? And do you know what? So, actually, I did read that the same. I read the same that masks are a thing. And do you know what? I think it's really fun that maybe people are experimenting and stuff. And maybe that's what they're doing in, you know, relationships and stuff. But I think for us, like with the singles that we talk to, you know, across the UK and the US, people are definitely more cautious about meeting up and a bit more nervous. And so that may be happening. I, you know, that wouldn't be my bag, but I think it's, you know, who knows what Corona's driving us to here.
How did you go about starting a dating app? So, because I think, you're quite right, there are lots of people out there who have had terrible experiences dating online and like, I'm sure I can do it better. Did you come from a tech background? Did you have to get a team together? What was the process?
Oh my goodness, a lot of grey hair came from it, because my background is not technology. In fact, I had a BlackBerry when I began this experience. I was working in interior design. I had no concept of what it took to build an app, but I just knew the problems that I wanted to fix. I just knew what I would like to feel like when I used it. So I came to it with a view of what, you know, what would make me feel more connected and more comfortable, as opposed to a coder that would come to it creating an experience that maybe, you know, wasn't in keeping with real life. And it was definitely a roller coaster journey, but what I did learn is that, you know, I know more about code than I ever thought I would. But you know, I think being open and just ask, you know, hiring the right people, getting together, you know, lots of different opinions, and just being open to make sure that you're going to build that product for the most people was key. And I was just obsessed by focus groups, and I loved getting bad feedback about the product. I loved it when people told me what they hated and what they loved when I was creating it, because for me, it just came from a real, you know, a real honest place. And I just wanted to make it as keeping in real life as we could. Because, you know, that's what being a wingman and a friend is about. It's that banter and friendship. And I wanted it to be about dating, but I also wanted it to be about elevating, you know, people that we know who are single, and whether that's our mum or our friends, I wanted to kind of help them be their best self. And so coming to it with that passion, I think sort of drove me through the darker days of creating this. And so, you know, when I see people using it and helping each other now, it's like so satisfying for me to see that.
Has it changed how you feel about dating? Has creating a dating app changed how you view the experience?
Well, I probably went on 300 dating apps before I created the experience, because I wanted to see what was out there, right? So I went from the very weird and wonderful to the very traditional because I wanted to see what was there. And do you know what? One of the thing is, it's just there are millions of people. No one wants the same thing. Like, everybody's looking for something different. And so for me, it was like trying to put myself in a lane that was kind of my lane, and not, you know, not drifting over into the hookup culture and stuff. And so it's always been about, you know, your wingman knows you best. So whether you are a bit of a weirdo, whether you are, you know, a techie or a rock star or whatever you are, it's about someone telling the world how great you are and pushing you to meet that person. I think from the 300 dating apps I've seen, there were some really bad experiences and some weird stuff happening. So, you know, I think it's just nothing is off book anymore. You know, people are so used to getting what they want instantly, and there's something out there for everyone at any moment that they want. So I think the variety is what surprised me the most.
I think that's really interesting, isn't it? Because sort of there is this weird randomness about dating apps, right? So there's this weird, you know, you scroll through people and you see somebody you quite like the look of, and suddenly that's it, you could be in a relationship with them. Whereas previously, you know, they might have known a friend of a friend, or you might have met them locally. There would be something to kind of ground it. Do you think getting your friends involved actually then maybe creates a bit of that sort of safety checking almost before you go too far?
Absolutely. That was one of the things I loved about having friends on the journey with me. And that isn't just because I'm a nervous nervous and didn't want to meet people. It's just sometimes you can't see the wood for the trees when you're looking on your own. And in an ideal world, we would all be able to meet someone that our friend knows. And so if I had, but unfortunately, the world just doesn't work like that. But I would say the one thing I am able to see is that from my experience, my friends who are single, I could spot someone that would be a great match for them on a dating app, but they probably would never join that dating app, right? Because they don't want to describe themselves and they feel there's a bit of a stigma attached. But I would just think, if I could put you two together and you know you like each other, you could go have some fun. And so for me, it was always about that. It was just kind of getting from A to B in a quicker way to connect people. And for me, you know, friends, when they are pre-approving people, they have a different view of who you should date sometimes to who you think you want. And so friends, when they're swiping for you and they're making those introductions, because whilst they're swiping like you do on Tinder, you are going a step further with Wingman, basically saying, this is my friend. Aren't they great? You're kind of pushing them in the front of them. So we're not really polite, but we're like, look how great my friend is. Do you want to meet them? And that's a yes or a no. And so for us, the fact that your friend even thinks you're going to get on, even if they may not be exactly what you would go for initially, the fact that a friend has thought something's interesting about them, you're going to give them more time than you ordinarily would.
And I think also it pushes you to date outside your comfort zone, doesn't it? Because, I mean, I certainly know that, like, the people that I would probably pick, I'm not sure my girlfriends would pick for me, and vice versa. I have a great girlfriend who does a lot of online dating, and I've had to ban her from swiping right on anyone who's wearing aviator sunglasses. I'm like, no, it doesn't work out. Let them go.
Yes, and you know what? You're absolutely right. Right, because you're not emotionally attached to that experience. You're able to be objective, and you'll be able to be like, why are you making this, you know, mistake again? And it doesn't matter if you are single or married. When you love someone and they're your friend, you're like, why are you doing this again? Like, I would have friends shaking their head at me, you know, me saying, oh, well, you know, I've met this person. He seems quite nice. And they're like, why are you even bothering? This is going to end in tears. This is horrible. And I would be like, no, you know, you just never know. And of course it ended in tears and it was terrible. But it's just, it's almost that you can't always take your own advice. It's a bit similar to that.
It is, isn't it? Fanny, do you think that, I mean, you said that, I thought it was quite interesting, you said people that are still less likely to put themselves on dating sites. Have we reached peak dating site yet? Or is there still some way to go? I mean, I've been on quite a few, so I feel like we must have reached it, but maybe we haven't.
I don't think we have. You know, the amount of people that we have brought online that have never used a dating app before has been huge, right? And I was surprised when we launched it in New York. I remember thinking, you know, New York is so forward thinking and people are really confident. Yet less than 40% of them used online dating because they were kind of in executive jobs and they didn't feel appropriate to use it. They didn't want to describe themselves. And there was this one guy who was a plastic surgeon who said, you know, I can't put myself on there. And I'm like, dude, you're a plastic surgeon. You're going to be snapped up. Right? Like, people will love you. And so, you know, his sister put him on there. And he said, yeah, you know, it's a different experience for me because I would never be comfortable using, you know, a dating profile. And so for that, just that one person alone, it's like for every one person that's like that, that's an extra person that's coming in that may ordinarily not meet their match. So having that broad audience for us, I think, definitely helped us to differentiate from the traditional single looking for a single, right? Because we have a different kind of focus.
And finally, Gina, I have to ask, you obviously started this app because you were online dating yourself. Have you found someone?
I have. And do you know what? I would love to say that I met him on the app because that would just be my best story. A friend introduced me to him and she said she was working at a company he was at. And she said to me, do you know what? I met this really strange Brit. He's more sarcastic than you. You guys should meet. And I was like, oh God, he sounds charming. That was it, right? There was something in it. So I ended up meeting him for a drink. We didn't date for about 6 months. And then here we are locked down, you know, living together in a pandemic. And I said to her, what was it about that you could spot for me? Because I wouldn't have thought he was my type. And she said, you know what? I just don't know. I had a bit of an insight that you would get on, your banter was the same, you had the same kind of life, you've grown up the same. So I don't know what it was really. I just thought they'd get on. And I think for us, it's like we're not a matchmaking site. We're not arranged marriage. We are about just the people that love you and are looking out for you, helping you dodge those dodgy aviator pictures like you're doing for your friends. If you do that, Tina, you're winning.
I think it sounds absolutely great. And I really hope I'm going to go check it out now and see which of my friends
Please
I can put on it.
Do. No aviators. Please put on aviators. The profile, if you wear aviators, do not approach my friend. You've got to be outspoken about it. That. You should.
Thank you so much, Tina. Tina Wilson, the CEO and founder of the Wingman Dating App. If you think you're not up for internet dating, maybe you need to get your friends on the case for you. Go check it out. 350% surge in online dating since the pandemic. Are none of us social distancing? Have we all forgotten?
You've been listening to Badass Women's Hour. If you like the show, then help more people find us. You can tag us or talk to us on social media using @BadassWomen'sHour. Or you can be really lovely and leave us a review and a rating. 5 stars, please. It helps boost us up the podcast rankings and allows other people to find us. We'll be back next week with more badass guests and in-depth chat.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.